Are you still grieving, even months after the passing of someone in your life? The effects of grief, loss, and mourning are long-lived, even if it seems the rest of the world has moved on. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May is Living with Grief, Bound by Sorrow, Wrapped in Comfort. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040, or look for Living with Grief at issuesetc.org. When you purchase Living with Grief, be sure to request the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May.
That's me in the spotlight, losing my religion, trying to keep up.
We all know that it's happening, that something is changing. The religious landscape of the United States is changing, and we sense that it's a decline of religion, its influence, its vigor, its numbers, most especially its numbers on the small scale and on the large scale. So how do you begin to quantify, how do you begin to measure the decline of religion in America? And how would America then compare to the religiosity of other societies? Are we headed for a European-style secularism here in the U.S.? We're going to be talking about the decline of religion in America. Lyman Stone joins us. He's senior fellow at the Institute for Family Studies, adjunct fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he studies and writes about demographics, family, and American culture. He and his wife serve as missionaries with the Lutheran Church Hong Kong Synod, and he's author of a recent column titled Promise and Peril, The History of American Religiosity and Its Recent Decline. Lyman, welcome back to Issues Etc.
It's good to be with you.
How would you describe, kind of generally, the role of religion in American society in the past?
That is a great question. I think it's a kind of a hot question, right? Because everyone wants to say, is America a fundamentally religious country, or is it fundamentally committed to secularism, or is it fundamentally this or fundamentally that? And my finding is it's not really fundamentally anything. That is that we have had periods of American history that were much more religious than the present day. And we've had periods of American history that were considerably less religious than the present day. We've seen enormous fluctuations over time. So some generations of Americans have chafed under our constitutional system, feeling that it was too secular and threatened their religious identity. Other generations of Americans have also chafed under it, feeling that it made too much space for religion and did not adequately protect society from these superstitious beliefs, right? So I think really the defining American experience of religion is kind of disagreement about this. It is sort of waffling between this idea of, are we a nation of religious promise, or are we a nation constantly beset by religious peril?
What are the measures of religiosity in a society?
So there are a lot of ways we can look at religion. One way we can get at this is directly is trying to figure out the scale of religiosity in society. So we can ask people, you know, do you believe in God or do you believe in hell? We can ask about specific beliefs. So that's a belief measure. Another way we can do this is by getting at people's identity. We can ask them, what religion do you identify with? Or with what religion are you affiliated? So this is a pretty low standard, right? You just say, I'm Lutheran, and whoever says they're Lutheran is Lutheran, right? Then from there, you can go to sort of a membership standard. You can say, well, okay, whatever you say you are, you know, are you a member of a church or a synagogue or a religious body? You know, what denomination is that body? Or we can even ask denominations the same question. How many members do you have? And then from there, we can go to behaviors. How often do you pray? How often do you go to church? You know, how do you tithe? We can look at behavioral standards. So really, we've got belief, we've got affiliation, and we have behavior. And kind of between affiliation and behavior, we have membership or belonging. So these are all different ways of looking at religious connectedness at the individual level. But we can also look at the place of religion in wider society. We can see its legal position. We can see people's attitudes towards other religions. We can see the position of religious violence. All these things that, even if they're not directly related to how many people are religious, they relate to how religious people experience their own religion.
So let's talk about those kind of in a big lump sum first, and then we'll take them apart. How do religious identification, affiliation, and behavior look in America in the past?
So religious affiliation in America, that is the share of people who, if you ask them, would say, yeah, I'm something. I'm Christian, I'm Muslim, I'm Jewish, I'm whatever. Just some religion. At virtually all points before the 20th century, in almost all societies, 90% or more of people were religious in some form. They would have identified with a religious identity. We do have some censuses from the 19th century that allow us to prove that. We have some primary source accounts that allow us to derive pretty good estimates. In fact, the most secular period I can find in any country before the 20th century is actually the United States around 1780, when maybe 8% of the population was, they said, nothingarian, which is an old term for non-religious. So religious affiliation has always been virtually uniform until the last few decades when it began to decline very rapidly. But religious affiliation is a very low standard, right? A lot of people can say they're something. So we can look at a slightly more demanding standard, which is religious membership. Are you actually a member of any denomination? Does any denomination claim you as a member? And when we look at it that way, the story is very different. What we can see is that American denominations claimed a very large share of Americans as members in the 17th century, so in the 1600s. And of course they did. This is the age of, you know, the Puritans and the Pilgrims and all these things. So, you know, upwards of 70, 80, maybe even 90% of Americans were members, or at least someone in their household was a member of a religious denomination. But that steadily declined throughout the 17th and 18th century. By the late 18th century, so by the period of the American religion, less than a third of adult Americans were a member of any religious body, which is pretty stark. That two-thirds of our society had no formal religious belonging anywhere. Now, they might have still been nominally Christian, but they had no actual connection to religion. But then from that low ebb until the middle of the 20th century, Americans became steadily more religious. So by the middle of the 20th century, just after World War II, almost 80% of Americans were members of a religious organization of some kind. And then it's declined. And today we're at about 60%. So that kind of traces out the ebb and flow of American religious history. A very religious founding in the 1600s, a rapid descent into secularism in the late 1700s. And then after the American Republic is launched, we see this long rise in religion until the last few decades when religiosity has declined again.
How would you describe that decline, at least in general terms of affiliation, identification, and behavior?
We've seen declines in all measures. So affiliation has fallen from approximately 95% of people to about 75% today. In terms of membership or belonging, we've seen the share of adult Americans who belong to a religious organization fall from about 75% to about 60% or even 55%. And in terms of attendance, that is, how frequently do people show up to church, or rather, what share of people are in church on a given week, that's declined from about 55% or so to today about 30%. Of Americans. So we've seen stark declines in nominal affiliation, in organizational belonging, and in actual, you know, butts in the pews. We've seen sharp declines in all of these across all measures.
How does American religiosity compare with other societies?
Americans have a reputation for being very religious. This is sort of the stereotype that Europeans have about Americans, is that we're all these religious fanatics. But this turns out to be complicated. Measured in terms of affiliation, Americans are middle of the pack. We are more religious than the super secularized Dutch, but we're less religious than Norwegians. We are more religious than French people or Brits, but we are less religious in terms of affiliation than Austrians or Italians. So purely in terms of affiliation, we are middle of the pack. We're not a particularly religious country. But where we stand out is in attendance, is in frequency of attendance. And this we can really get good data on from time diaries. That is where we ask people, record everything you did on this day. And then we can look at how many people said they went to a religious activity. And on that standard, we are a very religious country. Now, we don't have tons of different countries that have had this kind of survey done, but the only country where a time diary survey has been conducted that came up as more religious than the United States was South Africa. Italy was very close. Israel was very close. But South Africa is the only one that beats us. After Italy, Israel, and Austria, the next highest is South Korea, oddly enough. You also get strange things. I said the Netherlands is sort of this super secularized society in terms of affiliation. And yet in terms of attendance, Dutch people have higher church attendance than almost any other country in Europe. So really, comparing countries gets very perilous because different measures have very different relationships.
Does this decline in religiosity point to a secular future for America?
I think it can. The future, of course, we are not Calvinists, so the future remains in many of its, let's say, in the civil realm at least, it remains an open question. Of course, we know the ultimate future is set, and so that eternal future is, let's say, not secular. But, you know, in the near term, yes, it looks likely that America is going to become a more secular society. Religious people are going to make up a smaller share of the population. Religious ideas are going to be less welcome in public, and religious identities are going to be less prestigious. Barring some change, that is very likely to occur. And it's not just that. This has happened before, as I said, that America's had times where religiosity was relatively sort of ebbed. It was less common. But at that time, American population growth was very high. So we had this period where, yes, in the late 18th century, religiosity was declining as a share of the population, but population growth was extremely high. So even as religious people made up a smaller share of the population, their raw numbers were rising, which means they could support a growing arsenal of publishing houses and seminaries and church structures. And so even though they were shrinking as a share of the population, their individual institutions were growing. But that's not the situation now. Not only are we shrinking as a share of the population, but the population is not growing so fast. And so religious people have actually begun to decline in number in America by almost any measure. So this is really a new world to be in.
Is that really kind of the main difference between the present decline and previous religious low ebbs?
Yes, baseline population growth is absolutely the major difference. It's that in the past, even if religious people were a small share of the total population, their raw numbers were growing, and so investments would pay off, right? A seminary could take out debt to finance expansion because they knew there were going to be more students in the future. That's not the case anymore. The average denomination is shrinking. The average church is shrinking. Even in places where churches are growing as a share of the population, they're sometimes shrinking in absolute numbers. In fact, there's a lot of Lutheran churches. In fact, some of the most, if you look at LCMS churches as a share of their county population, some of the most successful churches in the LCMS, that is those that have grown their share of county population the most, are churches that are shrinking. It's just that they're shrinking slower than their surrounding counties. So this is really an unusual situation where even if you maintain as a share of population, it's very difficult to maintain your institutions because institutions depend on a fixed size of population, not a share of population.
What legal and policy changes have taken place regarding religion in America?
There have been so many changes. A major part of this project, of this report that I've published, was simply going through hundreds of state and colonial charters and constitutions and classifying dozens of different features in them by how it treated religion, how it treated different religions. Does it discriminate against a religion? What religion? Does it inhibit some religion's practice? Okay, what religion? Does it unequally treat religions? Does it explicitly support a religion? Does it limit religiosity? Does it, you know, classifying all these features so that we can actually get a benchmark of the legal position of religion in America? And what I find is that throughout American history, we've seen a pretty steady legal secularization. There have been periods where it was more stable, and there have been periods where it declined faster, but we've never seen a period in American history where the legal position of religion shifted in favor of more support for American religion across any meaningful time frame. We have not seen any such period, and it's very unlikely that we will see one. In fact, we live in a world now where the median state constitution, the median legal system that Americans live under, is pretty clearly disfavorable to religious identities and religious practice. That is, we don't live in a neutral society. We live in a decidedly non-neutral society that in fact kind of puts its thumb on the scales against religious identity.
Lyman Stone is our guest. We're talking about the decline of religion in America. On the other side, what does public discourse tell us about religious decline in the U.S.? Are you still grieving, even months after the passing of someone in your life? The effects of grief, loss, and mourning are long-lived, even if it seems the rest of the world has moved on. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May is Living with Grief, Bound by Sorrow, Wrapped in Comfort. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040, or look for Living with Grief at issuesetc.org. When you purchase Living with Grief, be sure to request the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May.
Since 1978, Lutheran Church Extension Fund has had the humble privilege of supporting Lutheran Church Missouri Synod Ministries and her workers. Thanks to faithful investors, LCEF has provided thousands of church workers, congregations, schools, and organizations with the low-cost loans and resources they need to reach more people with the saving name of Christ. To learn more, visit lcef.org or call 800-843-5233, 800-843-5233.
Education and edification. You're listening to Issues Etc.
I'm delighted to be chairman of Preach the Word Project, a project of our Synod to strengthen the preaching of all of us pastors in the Synod. We know how eternally important that is.
Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. Carl Fekencher talking about the new Preach the Word Project.
So we've put together a program of 12 modules that will be coming out this year and over the next 3 years on a variety of preaching topics for pastors to do together with two other pastors, two guys they trust, two guys they feel comfortable with, written materials and very fine video quality materials that are now becoming available.
Preach the Word helps pastors work together to improve their preaching with several resources and by interacting with seminary professors and fellow preachers. Find out more at lcms.org/preachtheword. lcms.org/preachtheword. Preaching is challenging business. We all can use some fresh ideas. lcms.org/preachtheword.
Looking for a foreign language program that will revolutionize your students' vocabulary knowledge and their understanding of grammar? How about a program that teaches critical thinking skills, too? Look no further than Memoria Press's Latin curriculum. Students of all ages can use these Latin study programs. Give your students the gift of Latin today. To order, visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR20. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Our pastors especially have carried a large burden to maintain Christ's instruction to provide word and sacrament ministry to their flocks. Thank your pastor by sending him an Ad Crucem greeting card or gift suitable for any budget. We recommend embroidered face masks, stunning posters confessing the faith, a crucifix or a pectoral cross, or how about a selection of Christmons? Recognize your faithful under-shepherd for upholding the office of holy ministry during these adverse circumstances. Visit adcrucem.com.
We're discussing the decline of religion in America with demographer and economist Lyman Stone. I'm Todd Wilkin. You're connected to Issues Etc. Lyman, You say that public discourse is important. What does it tell us about religious decline?
So one of the challenges in this whole project is when you want to say something about religion in the past, there's not always great data. So you have to get creative. So one of the things I did is I used a very large database of all published English language texts over the last few hundred years. And I searched those texts for a list of religious words, things like Trinity, sin, mosque, imam, faith, synagogue, Bible, you know, a list of these words. And I just categorized what share of all words in these texts are these religious words as an indicator of the religiosity of published language. I also did the same thing looking at legal cases. There's a large database of U.S. case law reaching back to the 18th century. And then finally, I looked up character labels in fictional texts. Things like priest, pastor, abbess, rabbi, monk, things like this that allow us to say, okay, how prominent are religious characters in the public imagination? And these things are a way of basically saying, what is the place of religion in public commentary, in public ideas? And what I find is that the position of religion was pretty stable during the 16 and 1700s. But then in the period immediately after the Civil War, religious ideas began to be much less common in published English language materials, particularly in American materials. And I think the reason for that is because the demand changed. And the reason the demand changed is because during this period, the educational system shifted to a more secular model, which means they needed more secular textbooks. And when they needed more secular textbooks, the entire educational system and publishing system had to change to adapt.
This is perhaps unexpected, but what does the choice of baby names tell us about religious decline?
So this was another place where, you know, if you say to someone, well, you know, the U.S. used to be more religious, now it's less religious, that's kind of, you need to put some numbers to that. And one of the places we can look for really high stakes significations of religiosity is in the names people give to their children. Kids named Hosea are probably going to be more likely to be religious, or at least their parents are more likely to be religious, than a kid named Bob, right? It's not that Bob can't be religious, he may be, but just the odds that Hosea's parents are totally non-religious seem low. Especially when you get to like a kid named like Asahel or like or Elihu or something, right? These parents are religious. So we can look at baby names. We can come up with a list of baby names. I use names in the Bible, Catholic saints, names appearing in the Quran, names of Hindu deities, and biblical virtue names. I'm going to use Bible names in English, French, and Spanish. And this is a proxy for the place of religion in the public imagination. The place of religion in the set of ideas that people see as prestigious and worth giving to their children. And what we see is that religious names were very common in the late 1700s and early 1800s. But then again, in the middle of the 19th century, particularly around the Civil War, religious names began to decline sharply in frequency. They stabilized a bit during the 20th century, but then they really gradually declined, and then over the last 30 years, they've declined precipitously. Baby boys tend to have more religious names than baby girls because baby boys tend to be named after their fathers, and their fathers tend to be named after their fathers, and their fathers after their fathers. Whereas baby girl names tend to be more frequently reflecting kind of the zeitgeist of the era. But what we see is that religion is simply less important as a source of things that people want to name their kids after.
What does the changing legal and policy environment play? What role does it play in declining religiosity in America?
It plays a decisive role. As I said, we've seen the legal position of religion change dramatically. And one of the places it's changed most is related to education. There is an abundance of academic literature showing that most change in religiosity at the societal scale over time is not driven by adults. Not driven by adults making rational decisions to move between one denomination or another. Virtually 100% of secularization occurs between the ages of 10 and 18. People become atheists when they're still at home with their parents. But why? There's a lot of evidence suggesting it's related to education, but it's not getting more education. Being more educated doesn't make you less likely to be religious. It's the specific kind of education you get. Being enrolled in a religious school, you can have just as good of test scores, you're not less likely to be religious. Whereas if you're enrolled in an explicitly secular school, like public schools, you may be more or worse educated, but you are less likely to grow up and be religious. This holds in natural experiments where we can exploit basically random variation, people who are sort of randomly deprived of religious education opportunities. This holds up in academic research. This holds up in numerous sources. What I find simply the most compelling proof is what I mentioned, that we can look at the religiosity that children have, and then we can look at what they have when they're 18. And we see that from the time people turn 18, their religiosity tends to rise for the rest of their life. It's not adults leaving the church. It's 13-year-olds leaving the church. And the reason they're leaving the church is because they're in educational environments that present them a model of prestige, of association, of, you know, a worldview, an approach to their life that says, even if religion's not bad, that religion's not necessary. It's not important. That there's that religious identities are not particularly prestigious. So it's not about they're exposed to science or education or rationality. It's purely about role models and environment.
What is a Blaine Amendment?
Blaine Amendments are what set this whole problem off. I've mentioned a couple times that there was really a big shift towards public secularization in the middle of the 19th century. Also during the middle of the 19th century, we actually do see this short downward blip in religious membership, although it recovered after that. And this is driven by Blaine Amendments. Blaine Amendments are named after a politician who tried to advance a federal Blaine Amendment. He failed, but a lot of states passed these amendments to their constitutions. And what they say is, basically, not one penny of public money can go to any religious institution, particularly religious schools. Now, they're usually phrased as limiting sectarian education. At the time, what that meant was limiting Catholic education, and to a lesser extent, and also Jewish education, and to a lesser extent, Lutheran education. The big groups targeted by Blaine Amendments were, number one, Catholics, number two, Jews, and to a lesser extent, number three, Lutherans. People felt that these were foreign religions that were corrupting Americans with foreign ways, and they needed to protect the country from these corrupting foreign religions by making sure that no public money could support these soul-rotting Catholic schools, right? So they imposed Blaine Amendments. Blaine Amendments begin in bigotry against Catholics, but today they have been radically expanded. I mean, they were bad enough when they were bigotry against Catholics, but what begins in bigotry ends as secularization. It ends as these same rules, no money for sectarian education, that, you know, Protestants put in place to try and discriminate against Catholics. Ultimately, they're used against Protestants to say, hey, no money for sectarian education. When you wrote that, you may have thought Protestantism wasn't a sect, but now it is. So it's important to understand that what begins as discrimination becomes secularization. You can't have a system where you legally privilege one religion without causing blowback. In fact, this is what drives the first wave of secularization in the 17th and 18th centuries. The established congregational and Anglican churches literally executed people for dissent. They arrested people for preaching other religions. They cracked down on dissenting religion, and as a result, they rendered themselves phenomenally unpopular. In the 17th century, Anglicans and Puritans made up at least 70% of Americans. By 1800, they made up 5%. Why? It wasn't because they didn't have babies. It wasn't because it wasn't just because immigrants displaced them. It was because they just so irritated everyone They just made enemies by discriminating. What begins in discrimination ends in secularization.
How has legal inequality changed for religious groups in America?
So there's a lot of ways that we can look at this. But one of the problems, sorry, I coded all these constitutional features and things like that. But one of the problems with this is that one man's inequality is another man's religious liberty. So let's say that your religion practices human sacrifice. You might see rules against murder as limiting your religious liberty. But the rest of us would say, rules against murder are not limiting religious liberty. They are simply protecting the good order of society. Now, so what it comes down to is, as long as there are not very many people who practice human sacrifice, rules against murder don't impact anyone's religious liberty, right? Because no one feels restricted by them, so they're not a problem. But if you had a lot of human sacrificers in your society, suddenly anti-murder rules might feel very discriminatory. So what we actually have to do to understand how the legal position of religion has changed over time is we have to actually look at the share of the population that had practices that faced legal discrimination. So I do that in a variety of different ways, but I find that the share of the population that faces legal discrimination fell pretty consistently from 1700 until 1900. Then it kind of stabilized or even rose a little bit during the early 1900s, but then it declined during the latter part of the 20th century. But then in the last few years, it's risen again. We've seen a little bit of increase in legal discrimination, particularly against Muslims. There are these laws called anti-Sharia laws that single out Muslims for special discrimination. And of course, those laws right now single out Muslims, but someday they will be used against Christians, because what begins in discrimination ends in secularization.
We're talking about the decline of religion in America. Lyman Stone is our guest, adjunct fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he studies and writes about demographics, family, and American culture. When we come back, we'll talk about the incidence of religious violence.
In sickness and in health, in these days of coronavirus panic, people are learning how difficult keeping this vow can be. The May issue of the Lutheran Witness looks at the wedding day. How does the couple plan their wedding with their pastor in a way that points to Christ, the only one by whom and through whom they can keep these impossible wedding vows? Read all about how Christ keeps his church in sickness and in health in the Lutheran Witness. Subscribe at cph.org/witness. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran perspective.
Did you know that Luther Academy has been providing continuing education for confessional Lutheran pastors and laypeople worldwide for more than 20 years? Luther Academy publishes Logia, the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatics series, and Luther Digest. Find out more about Luther Academy and sign up to receive their free email newsletter at lutheracademy.com, lutheracademy.com, and like them on Facebook, facebook.com/Luther Academy.
Throughout the 50 days of Easter, sacred music for the world. LutheranPublicRadio.org. Listen 24/7 to sacred music for the Easter season. LPR, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
This is Dr. Russell Dawn, president of Concordia University Chicago, with a message for parents, grandparents, and godparents of college-bound children. Concordia Chicago is a distinctive, comprehensive university of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. We're devoted to our Lutheran confession and committed to strong academics. Please encourage your child, grandchild, or godchild to check out Concordia University Chicago at cuchicago.edu.
Essential exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by becoming an Issues Etc. congregational sponsor: Bethlehem Lutheran, Altamont, Illinois; Faith Lutheran, Azona, Texas; Grace Lutheran, San Mateo, California; Emmanuel Lutheran, Lima, Ohio; Mount Calvary Lutheran, San Antonio, Texas, Peace Lutheran, Rapid City, South Dakota, Risen Savior Lutheran, Basor, Kansas, St. John Lutheran, Topeka, Kansas, St. Peter Lutheran, Indianapolis, Indiana, and Zion Lutheran, Tacoma, Washington. Find out how your confessional Lutheran church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to issuesetc.org, click Support, Donate, and print the one-page flyer. When your congregation becomes an Issues Etc. sponsor, we'll publicize your church on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. Death, Where Is Thy Sting? Featuring the Concordia University Concert Choir playing right now on Lutheran Public Radio. It's our 24/7 sacred music station. You can listen to sacred music for the Easter season anytime, anywhere at LutheranPublicRadio.org, on the LPR mobile app, and on TuneIn, Lutheran Public Radio. We're talking about the decline of religion in America. Lyman Stone is our guest senior fellow at the Institute for Family Studies. He's adjunct fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he studies and writes about demographics, family, and American culture. He and his wife serve as missionaries with the Lutheran Church Hong Kong Synod, and he's author of a recent column titled Promise and Peril, The History of American Religiosity and Its Recent Decline. Lyman, what do incidents of religious violence show us over time?
Religious violence has come in waves in American history. So there's a major wave of religious violence in the 16 and early 1700s. And again, this is this wave of established churches trying to crush their opposition. And this leads to the deep unpopularity of the established churches. But then things quiet down a bit for a variety of reasons. But then as Catholics begin to immigrate to the United States, and Lutherans in much larger numbers, and some Jews, in the middle of the 19th century, we see another major wave of religious violence, especially against Catholics and Mormons. Then things quiet down after the Civil War a bit, and then in the last half century, we've seen another major wave of religious violence in America, primarily targeting Jews.
How has secular education contributed to the decline of religiosity in America?
As I said, this is one of the most significant factors driving long-term religious change. Change among adults is not what drives secularization. What drives secularization is just that each subsequent generation of kids grows up a little bit less religious. And they grow up a little bit less religious, not necessarily because their parents are so much less religious, but because their educational environment undermines parental choices. If we want to undo this, the solution, of course, is not to force people to have school prayer. Again, making people feel persecuted is not going to increase religion. We don't want to force an atheist kid to pray a prayer he doesn't believe. We want to give families choices. An atheist family should be able to put their kid in a secular school. And a Lutheran family should be able to put their kid in a Lutheran school. And there should be no discrimination between those. The government should not have financial favoritism between these two options. A family should be able to use their public school money on any school that meets basic curriculum standards.
You've discussed this at length already, but kind of bring it together for us. How has the decline of marriage and family contributed to the decline of religiosity?
So education is a huge component, but there is this other component about adults. We do see some changes in the pace at which adults return to the church. And, of course, if they take longer to return to the church, then they are less likely to have a strong attachment to it, and especially their children are less likely to have a strong attachment to it. So what drives this delayed return is simply delayed marriage. And one of the tightest correlations we can see between long-run religiosity and other social factors is simply the share of the adult population that's married. married people start to settle down into other communities. Married people start to have kids, which means they will look for childcare, which means they start to think, oh, what values do I want to teach my kids? These types of questions lead them to religious institutions. So the correlation over time, both ups and downs across multiple waves, between marital status and religiosity is extraordinarily close. It's a close correlation at the individual level and at the societal level. And there is good academic research suggesting it's not just a correlation, it is causation. Being married makes you more likely to attach yourself to religion.
What role has worship style played?
Worship style has played no role in secularization. I know this will be surprising to some people because, especially for religious folk, the worship wars loom very large. And I was convinced that this was not a real issue, that no one could really believe that long-run changes in religion were because of people disliking organ music. I just thought this was so far-fetched. But I was persuaded by several people that this is actually something I should look into. And actually, our church is a wonderful case study of this, because the great thing about LCMS is we keep really detailed records. We have relatively strict doctrinal standards, but we have relatively loose standards about style of worship. And also, we tend to be really, really, really divisive. Now, being divisive is perhaps not a good thing, but it's a convenient thing for formal analytic study, because what it means is there are clearly defined factions within LCMS. That is, there are websites that you can get online, and you can look up, I want a church that has a very traditional liturgy. I want a church that has a very missional outlook. I want a church that has this. I want a church that has this. And you can sort of go shopping through your Lutheran buffet of the exact kind of church you want. And there's very good data on this, which means we've got churches that don't have a lot of doctrinal difference. Their history is similar. We have good data on them, but they have clearly defined differences in style. So we also have a lot of data on, do they have schools? How much do people donate to these churches? All these other variables that we can use to control for different types of variation. And what I find is that highly liturgical LCMS churches have the exact same trajectory of decline as less liturgical LCMS churches. Doesn't matter what controls you throw in. If you control for local population, if you control for prior age of church, if you control for the natural change in church, like births and deaths, if you control for financial giving, if you control for attendance rates of members, if you control for the presence of a church school, the size of the church school, if you control for the duration a pastor has been in a church, the number of pastors, it doesn't matter what controls you throw on there. Liturgical style makes no difference to the growth of a church. What makes a difference to the growth of a church is if members of the church show up, if they enroll their kids in the church school, if they give generously from their resources, and if they are invested in their community. That is, if they actually make an effort to support the growth of their church. There's a lot of academic research showing this, by the way. I didn't invent this finding. It turns out that there's a repeatedly demonstrated finding that the best predictor of church growth isn't style, it's not doctrine, it's none of these things that make for nice church political fights. What determines church growth is simply if you care about your church enough. And I know that sounds callous, but if you're out there inviting people to church, if you're out there telling people, hey, we have a church school, and even though it costs me money, I enroll my kid in it. Even though we have to make sacrifices in our life, I tithe to my church. I make sure that we have a pastor. I make sure that we have a DCE if we need one. I make sure we have an associate pastor. Deep commitments to churches lead to church growth. Shallow commitments to churches lead to church decline. It's that simple.
Is America headed for a European level of religiosity?
At current rates, yes, we are. It'll take a little while to get there. You know, this wouldn't be the first time in American history that we have a persistent decline for a century. It could be several decades. But yes, that is where we're headed if things don't change. If we don't find a way to fight the educational battles in a more productive way. If we don't find a way to stop fighting over style questions and start doubling down on on frankly just being good churches. If we don't actually start to fight the battles that matter, supporting families, helping young people transition to marriage, to homeownership, to stability, helping young people transition to having kids and having the number of kids they want to have and having them early enough, helping people transition into adulthood as fast as possible, managing our educational institutions in such a way that they're financially durable and also that they can allow students to complete their education speedily. We need to be thinking about not simply can we train people for this wider social milieu, but we need to be thinking about a genuine demographic survival strategy. Evangelism is a huge part of that. Helping people get married is a huge part of that. Helping people get educated in an affordable and efficient fashion is part of that. Helping people have the child, the family that they want is a big part of that. This needs to be a whole church effort, a whole life effort. It has a political front. It has a spiritual front. It has an economic front. It has a social front to it. And if we fail at it, we will simply end up losing 30, 40, 50, 60, 70% of our congregations over the next few decades. We'll shut down a seminary. We'll shut down most of the Concordias. And our children will have a difficult time finding spouses, let alone of the same denomination, but of Christianity at all. And will have a very difficult time catechizing their children.
Finally, what do religious leaders need to know about the decline of religion in America?
I think there's two big takeaways that I have for religious leaders. First is be aware that the tide is going out. Population growth is low, which means getting any church growth is more challenging than in the past. The tides of culture are against you. Be aware of that. But then my second piece of advice would be do not be discouraged by that. This is not the first time that religiosity or Christianity or Lutheranism has been on the retreat in temporal terms. But although in this world we may sometimes appear to be downtrodden, we believe that ultimately our faith is a cosmological truth, not simply a temporal strategy. Yes, we may experience defeats now in the social realm. We will not experience defeat forever. And frankly, I do not even believe we will experience defeat forever in the social realm. There are plausible political strategies advocating for child allowances, marriage benefits, advocating for school choice, advocating for lighter zoning regulations, more affordable education. All these things will meaningfully increase religiosity in America. They'll also increase population growth. Advocating for more open immigration is a strategy that will keep a lot of churches afloat. This has kept the Catholic Church afloat. And of course, the people who immigrate here, they're not nominal Catholics, right? Hispanics tend to be very devout Catholics. Ethiopians tend to be very devout Lutherans. Malagasy people as well. People from Northwest Indonesia. There are millions of Lutherans around the world who would very much like to move to America. So these are all viable strategies. But beyond that, at the church level, the encouraging thing I take away is that the defining factors that drive church growth are not these social factors. The churches that grow are not well predicted by these sort of aggregate social forces. They're predicted by if a large share of members show up to church on Sunday. They're predicted by if a large share of members have their kids in the school. They're predicted by if tithes represent a large share of what I guess church-wide income is likely to be based on, you know, church demographics and population and local incomes. Churches that decide that they are going to survive come hell or high water succeed in doing so. Churches that float along hoping that tweaking this or that song choice, this or that little thing, you know, switching the brand of coffee at coffee hour, that this is going to change things. No, that will change nothing. A commitment to discipleship, evangelism, family, and catechesis works, which of course it does, because that's what we're told in Scripture will work. because that is essentially a way of saying that proclaiming the gospel works.
Lyman Stone is senior fellow at the Institute for Family Studies. He's adjunct fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he studies and writes about demographics, family, and American culture. He and his wife serve as missionaries with the Lutheran Church Hong Kong Synod, and he's author of a recent column titled Promise and Peril, The History of American Religiosity and Its Recent Decline. You can read it at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk On Demand Archives. Lyman, as always, thank you very much.
Thank you. Glad to be on here.
Dr. Nancy Almodovar has written a kind of heart-wrenching story called Assurance, The Journey to Lutheranism, Her Dark Night of the Soul Under Reformed Theology, until she discovered the certainty of the Lutheran Confession. It's in the latest online Issues Etc. journal, and it's absolutely free, along with an article that I've written on closed communion, biblical, historical, Lutheran, and loving. Subscribe at our website, issuesetc.org. Click the red subscription button and enter your email address. We'll send you the latest Issues Etc. journal online and absolutely free. Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll discuss Old Testament patriarch and prophet Job. Does he suffer because of some secret sin? Dr. Kevin Golden will answer that question. We'll talk with Pastor Ted Geese about two types of nostalgia-driven entertainment, and we'll play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
I've written a column for the latest Issues Etc. journal titled Closed Communion, Biblical, Historical, Lutheran, and Loving. We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red journal subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Dr. Nancy Almodovar writes about her journey from the profound doubt produced by her former Calvinist beliefs to the absolute certainty of Lutheran theology. The free online Issues Etc. journal, issuesetc.org.
St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Wildwood, Missouri is a proud sponsor of Issues Etc. And if you enjoy the relevant, Christ-centered teachings presented on this program, then you should come and join us at St. Paul's on Sundays at 9 a.m., where you will hear sermons that proclaim Jesus Christ and Him crucified for our sins, and enjoy in-depth Bible studies to help us grow as disciples. For more information, check us out at stpaullutheranwildwood.org.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
The Holy Trinity addresses three important things for the reader.
Dr. Carl Beckwith talking about his book in the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatics series, The Holy Trinity.
It explains the difficulties we face in confessing the Trinity in our world today. It shows how Scripture carefully and decisively presents the Trinity, and it rehearses the sound pattern of words used by the Church to clarify and defend the witness of Scripture.
Learn more about the Holy Trinity at lutheracademy.com, lutheracademy.com.
This week on The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, we'll continue our romp through Romans, exchanging the natural for the unnatural. Stop the judging already! Christ, the only judge, the conscience, and an honest appraisal. Join me, Pastor Will Whedon, for The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, your daily 15-minute, verse-by-verse Bible study on demand at thewordendures.org and on the Lutheran Public Radio app.
Did you know that we send out an email each week that details upcoming show topics? It's available for you to include in your weekly church bulletin. Just click the Issues Etc. Journal logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org, and sign up to receive the church bulletin blurb. It's an easy way to invite your fellow parishioners to listen to Issues Etc. issuesetc.org. Look for the Issues Etc. Journal logo and register to receive a weekly bulletin paragraph from Issues Etc.
Would you like to learn about the Reformation theology you hear on Issues Etc.? We'll send you a pamphlet of Luther's Small Catechism for free. It contains the biblical teachings on the Ten Commandments, the Apostles' Creed, the Lord's Prayer, baptism, the Lord's Supper, and confession and absolution. Order your free copy of Luther's Small Catechism today. Just send your name and mailing address to talkback@issuesetc.org.
Give your mom the gift of a clean home for Mother's Day with a gift certificate from The Cleaning Authority. Gift certificates can be purchased for as little as $75 for a partial clean. Go to gifts.thecleaningauthority.com, enter your contact information, and choose the amount. Give the gift of time for your mom with a Mother's Day gift certificate from The Cleaning Authority. Gifts.thecleaningauthority.com. Gifts.thecleaningauthority.com.